Hi, Jazz Bastard Podcast 108 is about to start. Just an apology. We had technical difficulties, and my voice especially is kind of garbled and tinny for about 10 minutes. It does get better 15 minutes or so into the episode. We're not sure what the cause of the problem was, but we're hoping next time things go smoother. Enjoy. Jazz.
And I don't do the intro again. Let's do it.
Come on. I don't plan to. I'm hoping it was recorded.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's your official welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 108. I'm Pat.
I'm Mike.
Here's hoping we save the introduction of these four big band albums. We're trying for our third time to discuss Michael Foreman Acts the Distance, Darcy James Argue's Real Enemies, Maria Schneider's The Thompson Fields, and Thelonious Monk's Big Band and Quartet Live from 1963. And as before, I suggest we begin discussion with the big band album by Thelonious Monk, kind of a ringer. It's an old classic that was recently reissued as a kind of premium 2LP version. Found myself liking it quite a bit. So what did you think of Big Band and Quartet by Thelonious Monk?
So the issue I have with this, it's a minor issue, but it is an issue nonetheless, is that I tend to prefer Thelonious in small settings. I like him in quartets and trios. There's a kind of spontaneity and a kind of rough-hewn shambolic majesty about those smaller settings that a big band production of his music tends to sand off some of the edges, and for me takes out some of the tension. We've talked about it before, obviously. You've made the excellent point that some of the solos here are actually quite ferocious, and I agree that's a huge compensation. But for me, I guess I prefer Thelonious in a less ornate setting with just quartet or a trio. The more heavily arranged and orchestrated big band setting, I think, takes away some of what I most value in his music, which is those moments of tension, that sense of spontaneity, that, you know, anything can happen. And when you think about it, just the word arranger paired with Thelonious Monk just seems weird, because he's like the anti-arranger, the way he composes and the way he interprets his own compositions. They're just so angular and crab-wise. And an arrangement naturally has to sort of be, to some degree, linear. It has to kind of organize horizontally and vertically all the sound fields. And for me, that just takes away some of what makes Thelonious so exciting. It's a valuable recording, and it's beautifully recorded. It sounds fantastic. But I think, less a fan of this than you are. Although I like it quite a bit, I have to agree with you. It's strong. I prefer other Thelonious to this.
Well, yeah, and you certainly can argue that this is not, the arrangements are not an extension necessarily of Thelonious's art. He's not the one crafting them. It's Hal Overton.
Right.
Yeah, whereas, say, Charles Mingus or Duke Ellington, part of their vehicle for self-expression is the arrangement. In the case of Monk, not so much. Now, thinking about this, especially his Riverside period, which comes right before the Columbias, and is probably the mother lode. If you're new to Monk, you probably want to start looking at those mid to late 50s, very early 60s recordings on Riverside first. And, you know, possible if you can try the trio we did with Blakey on Prestige. That's just really delightful. I mean, that I think of as the absolute jewel in the crown of his stuff. But, you know, the Columbia years are maybe a little bit tireder and more repetitive in some cases. I don't really think in this album. But there's a lot to value there. And, of course, for a lot of people, that was their introduction to him because, of course, Columbia was by far the biggest best publicized, far-reachingest label he was on, right? It was the majors he made it, and it kind of brought his profile to a new level, even if the music wasn't necessarily quite as good as the Riversides. But, you know, thinking about his first solo album on Riverside, Thelonious himself, you know, he's the one that comes up with the idea of, instead of ending with yet another solo piece, bring in Coltrane and the bass player. And he breaks the theme that his producer had set up. And, of course, it's a brilliant ending to that album. It's unexpected, but it works. And, again, you know, when he opens Monk's Music with that just gorgeous arrangement of Abide With Me, right, with, you know, played with all the
right.
horns together and all those rich overtones, and you've got Coleman Hawkins and John Coltrane together. Again, it's unexpected. So I'd argue that at least at his prime, he was a bit of a conceptualist, even if he wasn't an arranger. In other words, he would come up with ideas, both for repertoire and for, you know, little, I guess, one-offs or odd little performances that didn't necessarily occur to other people. And they kind of added a richness to his best records. It wasn't just necessarily a group cutting some tracks and leaving. Just like he insists on using, I think, his Brilliant Corners, where he's like, I've got to use the, it wasn't a harpsichord, it was some other...
Marimba keyboard. Or no, something, or clavinet or something?
Something like that. He finds this second keyboard, Celeste, that's it, in the studio, puts it at right angles to the piano, and insists on playing each keyboard with one hand, which, of course, makes the engineers weep tears of blood as they have to figure out how to deal with this. And, of course, the producer's, like, slowly setting himself on fire because they're running out of time. So I do think he's got an imagination that goes beyond just, you know, let's get the group together and play. That said, he's not necessarily the one employing that in the setting. I just found it, I think, partially coming at it from the angle of a little bit of guilt because I spent $40 on the stupid LP reissue on an album I never heard, and thinking, boy, I hope this is not the slightly tired Columbia Monk. And I was a little worried.
Right.
I'd just gotten a prestige item, not in the sense of the label, but, you know, just a collectible item that wasn't necessarily intrinsically all that great. And then it's like, oh, shit, this music is really good. I'm really engaged here. The soloists, Phil Woods and Thad Jones, really are both excellent. I don't know that Woods surprises me. He just plays some of the best solos he ever has, but very much in his style. Whereas Thad Jones, he's kind of bubbly and reminds me a little bit of Clark Terry a bit. And it's just it's a little unexpected fleetness and humor in his playing. Not that Thad is a better cornet player than most people realize. He tends to be thought of as the least famous of the Jones brothers and best known for arranging. But he's a fine horn player, and his solos are great. Steve Lacy's in the ensemble, doesn't solo, which is kind of shocking when you think of how much of his life he devoted to Monk. But I feel like there is enough energy and enough raggediness there that it's not too process sounding. The solos are fantastic. And when Monk just sits down by himself to play Darkness on the Delta, when is Darkness? Where the fuck did he come up with these things? I mean, he's got this amazing repertoire of obscurities from the 20s and 30s that he will turn into kind of... He's both almost taking the mickey out of them, but he's so also sincere in his love of them that they're just fantastic, moving performances. You know, Just a Gigolo, or in this case, When is Darkness on the Delta? His whole sense of what the songbook should consist of is also just incredibly distinctive. His covers are somehow almost as smart as his compositions. So I found it a really fulfilling package. I like it a lot. But yeah, I agree. I mean, overall, if I had to have Monk in small groups or Monk in big groups and listen to only that for the rest of my life, yeah, I'd plump for Monk in small groups.
Yeah,
for Christmas, my special gift was they had a 25% sale at Acoustic Sound, and they've made this series of 7 ridiculously overproduced LP versions of the sessions Monk did on Riverside with tenor players. So I got those. They're kind of reproductions of the original LPs, some of which are kind of short, but sounding as good as they humanly can, priced accordingly. And so I've been going back to that. It's weird. I mean, it's a weird thing for me because I feel like for many years I just didn't listen much to Monk because I listened to him so much in high school and college that he kind of got internalized. You know, it's like, how often do you play Kind of Blue kind of thing.
Right.
It's been fun to kind of go back there. Well, that's our take on Big Band and Quartet. You won't be sad if you listen to that album in some form. It doesn't have to be LP. If you get the CD, you'll actually get more of the music there. But any format, it's enjoyable. It's probably not the first Monk purchase you should make, but you won't go wrong with it. Okay, where do you want to go next? Do you have a preference for the Big Band projects from the modern era?
Let's do the Formanek next. After the first two cracks at this, I started to grok this a little bit, and I started to like it more. And it's still not at a kind of Darcy James Argue level for me, but I like it a great deal more than I did. Like, part of my motive for trying to pay more attention to it is just that it's got so many players on it who appear in other bands that I like. It's the Brooklyn usual suspects.
Right, yeah.
Mary Halverson, Chris Davis, Thomas Fujiwara, they're like all here. Kirk Nefke, right? It's just one after another of these guys, these players who play on each other's projects and appear endlessly, you know, sort of cross-pollinating groupings. And I thought, there has to be more to this that I'm just not paying enough attention to. And so I think in the first two cracks we had at this, my verdict was ECM with a little bit of spine, but it still kind of left me cold. And now what I'm kind of interested in when I listen to it is I like the bottom on this a lot. That is to say, I think it's Oscar Noriega who plays bass clarinet and Tim Byrne apparently only playing Barry Sax here. I know, it's hard to believe. There's some deep bottom on a number of the numbers on this album. And at least one of the guys is playing a bass trombone a bunch of the time. So you get this sort of plummy tuba sound as well. And I really like that. That's something I've always liked about Sun Ra. And this is nothing like Sun Ra, but it does have that kind of really thick bottom on a lot of the numbers, which it's sort of really plummy and rich. And I do like that. And some of the numbers now started to settle for me a little bit. I like them a little bit better than I did before. So the opener, The Distance, I take it that is the opener.
Yeah, it's weird because he does two pieces and then he has this long suite,
which is broken into parts, yeah.
But they all, it's not like we're going to do a couple light pop songs. And then, you know,
right.
they're all kind of a piece. I don't know why they couldn't have been two more parts of the suite.
Yeah, so The Distance is actually kind of slow and meditative, and it is very ECM-y, and things pick up on some of the later numbers. I think I have a preference for part one and part two, which are linked together in a single number for reasons that I don't understand, at 21 minutes.
Yeah.
Really? You couldn't split those into two 10-minute tracks? And part six, which has some really fine solos on it. Clarinet solo is quite good on that. My one regret, maybe, if there's a regret here now, is that there isn't more Mary shredding. She shreds some, but not enough.
I know. This is a good context for her. I think her playing is just prime Mary, and primer is about as Well, that's almost a word. It's about as good as it gets. I mean, she's not always in her happy place for me, but in this album, I'm like, fuck yeah. No, give her another 10 choruses. Fuck yeah.
I know, I know. I could use more Mary. Turn her up to 11, you know, let her go for a while. Yeah, I wish she would have had more opportunity to stretch out, because she is one of our favorite players, and I think she's in very good form here. But yeah, I actually have grown to like this a little bit more than our first two cracks at this, where I didn't like it that much. I didn't hate it, but I'm sort of, you know, pissing on it as kind of latter-day ECM murk. And I guess my verdict is, if you stick with it, things emerge from the murk. It repays attention, but slowly. This wasn't an album that I picked up on quickly. The fact that we had to sort of keep coming back to these albums really paid off for this particular album. The others, we'll say more about that in a minute, but in this one, like, the extra attention seemed to work for me, and I like it a little bit more than I did before.
Cool.
So it's okay. A little more enthusiasm for me this time about it.
And I'd say the murk, in as much as it's very complicated, thorny compositions, lots of instruments, but I'd say sonically, the louder the better, and it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
I mean, just as a bath of sound. Mm-hmm. I was listening to it probably a month ago, around one or around two in the bedroom, and it was a little louder than usual. I just realized I was just happy on a sensual level because of the beauty of the sound coming out of the speakers, not necessarily the sense, just, wow, you know, this is just rich and nourishing and thorny, and, you know, it's not all pillowy or consonant, but it does get pretty far out a few times. I don't know if those are my favorite sections. You know,
Metamorphic sounds a little bit like a traffic jam, you know?
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, this highly conceptual approach to music, I don't know that... Sometimes I feel like people freak out just to show, it's like, we know this is authorized. This is okay. We can do this. We can play atonal. I'm not always sure it fits or it pays off. I don't know that... You know, I'm fine. I mean, you've got my permission to do it. It's not going to scare me, but, you know, I just didn't feel like it was super productive for those musicians or that project. I mean, it wasn't terrible by any means. It wasn't super self-indulgent. But Mary, who is both always on Saturn, but yet somehow grounded and using musical motifs and rhythmic ideas and playing with tone in a way that, for me, adds up to something that makes sense musically, just great. Both her comping section, there's one where she comps pretty audibly, and then one where she scronks pretty audibly, and they're both just fantastic. But a lot of good solos here. I feel like these contexts tended to produce interesting solos from the participants that didn't go on too long. Foreshadowing. I liked them, and I felt, I don't know, I feel like there are some interesting melodic, might be too strong, but, you know, motivic ideas here, and, you know, at times it gets pretty straightforwardly jazzy. And then others, it's more abstract, but it's not always two-thirds streamy. And there is some texture and bite to the sound. I mean, the problem we found with some ECM recordings, especially recently, say, Tim Burns, is that you feel like the edges have really been sanded off to a degree that doesn't benefit the music. Some artists just don't fit in that sound world of Manfred's. But on baritone, you know, I was thinking of that. I've still never seen The Marathon Man, but... Laurence Olivier asking, is it safe? It's like, yes, Tim only has a baritone, it's safe. He doesn't have his alto, it's safe.
Please. Yeah, and I'm going to endorse something you said, which is, if you get this, put on the big boy headphones and turn it way the fuck up, and you'll enjoy. This is definitely, you know, to be turned up. It rewards that kind of bathing in the sound.
Yeah, absolutely. One quality of much artsier music is that it really rewards and kind of demands that kind of attention and that kind of dominance of your sound field. If you're playing it through your iPhone speaker in the shower or whatever, you're really getting nothing from it in a way that you might from an early Kinks song, or you might from, I don't know, some EDM where the job it's doing doesn't require that you hear all the nuances. And that doesn't mean it's less valuable. It's just, it's got a different job. It's got a different contract is making with the position of the noise it's making in your life and the amount of attention you need to grant it. This is kind of demanding a lot of attention, and just like most classical music I found, that's the thing. If you get into classical music, I'm getting more as into it as I age. Not all of it, but some of it I'm liking quite a bit. And it's like, yeah, if I'm going to play the Alpine Symphony, it's just going to have to rock the walls at times, or it's not going to work. You know?
Right.
Because some of it's very, very quiet, and you know, the dynamic range is enormous, and a lot of it's about just, you know, soaking in the texture like you would a hot tub. And if you try to put it in on the background, it just, you might as, you know, play something else. That's fine. You don't, it's nothing wrong with that. It's just that particular kind of music won't reward you. Yeah, I really like this. I don't think he's done a lot of other large ensemble stuff. My sense from reviews was this was kind of out of left field. He's a bass player, and it's not like this is some bass feature.
He works with a number of these people.
Yeah.
He was on Thumbscrew, so.
Okay.
So he's worked with Halvorsen and some of these others. And again, there is a sense of like, these are people who appear on each other's albums with some regularity. So, yeah.
And you get the sense that, at least from reviews, I'm not someone who's followed his career, that this was kind of a stepping up of his game. You know, it was kind of an album that, not that he'd been putting out bad music before, but kind of caught people by surprise. And they kind of said, wow, I mean, this guy's got more up his sleeve than we thought. This is more than just a very fine bass player who kind of, you know, lives in the near edges of the avant-garde. This is somebody who's can put together a really interesting, complicated, you know, large ensemble album and make it work. And, you know, we've talked about large ensemble albums before that, for whatever reason, kind of struggled one way or another. So it's not the easiest thing to pull off. Anyway, I recommend, I liked it. I mean, for me, probably Monk is complicated because I love him so much and he's so central and towering to the music. But of the modern albums, this is my clear favorite. I know you like Ghosty better, but
yeah.
Okay. Where do you want to go next?
Let's get Thompson Fields out of the way.
I might have said that earlier, and I'm on board with you then. The lovely Maria Schneider and the lovely package that she put together.
This you left is out a, lovely and talented. You're supposed to say lovely
and
talented.
And she is. I mean, you know, this is somebody that we think of as coming out of the Gil Evans School of Arranging. Or I talked a little bit about Tom Harrell's first impressions last time and how it wasn't necessarily a cliched impressionistic album in the sense of lots of pastel shapes drifting by harmonically. He tended to look for riffs and motifs and kind of get vamps going to solo on. Not that they were super funky vamps, but you know, he was looking for a little bit more thrust. Here, this is kind of, if you want to talk about the influence of the Impressionists or somebody who's interested in drifting clouds of pastel harmonies, yeah, she's of that school. And it's an album about, I guess, where she grew up. Mm-hmm. And it was a self-financed project. I think it was kind of crowdfunded. It's through Artist Share. And I bought it on CD, and by gum, it comes in this beautiful book that has lots of photographs of where she grew up and maps and pictures of flowers and long discussions, narratives, really, about what inspired some of these pieces. Some of the personnel, and Steve Wilson is on alto and numerous reeds. Donnie McCaslin, we're hearing a lot more about him because he was kind of the musical director and tenor player on David Bowie's last album. Who else might even? Gary Versace on accordion. Frank Kimbrough on piano. Frank used to work a lot with Ben Allison, the bass player.
Right.
Very large ensemble. I'm just naming a few people whose names kind of leap out to me. I think Scott Robinson is a guy that has extended alto clarinet solo on one of the pieces. So thoughts about Thompson Fields?
Mm. Well, in the same way, sorry, not in the same way, the repeated listenings really helped me with Michael Formanek's album. I cannot say the same is true of the Thompson Fields. It's hard. It's hard to say, but we both like her a whole bunch, and she's got talent to burn and blah, blah, blah. And man, this just doesn't make me happy. It doesn't make me unhappy. It just makes me sleepy. It's nice. And that's not a big compliment. It's nice. It's nice. It's kind of snoozy and dreamy and just doesn't that doesn't touch my pleasure zones. It doesn't make me happy. And I like me some spacey, dreamy stuff, but this just feels kind of marshmallowy and wandering. And you object a lot to the sort of folkiness of it. I just feel like there's no tension. I don't feel like this builds and releases tension in any consistent or interesting ways. And that's what really gets on my nerves. It feels like a lot of nice, soft throw pillows on a very big modular couch unit where you can't really sit up because you're just laying back. And I get a neck ache and a headache after a while. And I kind of want a back to the chair once in a while. I want a little rigor with the soft. And everyone here is incredibly talented. They're all really good. It's just, it doesn't do a lot for me. This just feels kind of listless to me.
I want one of those chairs you put the money in and they vibrate. Anyway, please continue.
I mean, I hate to say these things because I really like her, but this recording for me was not, and repeated listenings did not make me like it any better, even with the people on here whom, you know, I really like. I've really gotten into Ryan Keberly, and I just, this album just doesn't do it for me. If you like your jazz, welcoming and not very, if you like jazz that kind of curls up with you and doesn't snap and bite your ankles, this might be the album for you. And also, one could argue, and maybe you will in a second, is this jazz? Because where are the solos?
Solos. I mean, there are very, very long solos, but yeah.
That's what I mean. I mean, they feel, right. I mean, they feel like they're part of the background almost. I don't get a sense of building tension. It's not like, you know, Paul Gonzalez here is, right, you know, ripping off 32 choruses.
Though some of the solos as long as that solo, they just
do.
Yeah.
It's some very beautiful playing here, very talented people, and it just didn't strike a chord with me at all. I didn't like this much at all.
Yeah, I have been, and listening to it again, remain, unthrilled by this. I do appreciate what she's doing and the great difficulty of bringing a band together for a project like this, and her organizational and promotional skills, as well as her obvious musical skills, to get a project like this off the ground, and they're awe-inspiring, and I'm glad she could do it. My worry is that some person who thinks they might be slightly interested in jazz hears that this won all these prizes, puts it on, and then decides, man, jazz is boring. And it's like, no, but this record is kind of boring. Moments in it, I wonder, are there certain harmonic progressions or voicings of chords that just really only belong in sentimental movies? I don't know. I mean, I just feel like they're objectively sentimental.
You know, it's like, I'll give you a good example, like the monarch and the milkweed, right?
Yeah.
So monarch butterflies, you know, subsist on milkweed, right? So you expect a certain kind of delicacy of playing, blah, blah, blah. I totally get it, right? Think about Conference of the Birds, right? Lots of incredibly delicate, intricate playing there, and yet tension, like passionate tension, like just utter engagement. And Monarch of the Milkweed is exactly what you just said. It feels very sentimental and very saccharine. And I don't mean to diminish or tread on her memories of her past. Perhaps this is a sonic rendering of something terribly important to her. But it's not resonating with any kind of passion in this listener anyway.
Well, I think that one way of putting it is that her backgrounds don't seem to inspire or prize out inspired playing from the musicians who solo at such agonizing length on the pieces. I mean, Donnie McCaslin, you go out and get a quick massage, come back, still no happy ending. They go on and on, but the chord changes they're playing over or the lack of interactivity or prodding from the background just seems to lead to a kind of one thing after another soloing that as you said, doesn't build tension, doesn't seem to go anywhere, is very accomplished technically, but just doesn't add up to much of musical interest in as far as I can tell. I don't like the solos on this album. They don't seem like these musicians who are all extremely talented people are getting in that place where you're playing above your head and the melodies you're spinning out seem like they may have been pre-composed and they just fall together, and yet there's that sense of excitement and discovery that they haven't been all written out and pre-planned. They just seem to kind of meander.
Yeah. That's a good word. And again, I'm coming back to the Monarch and the Milkweed for a second. That builds over its 12-minute length. And toward the end, we get trading solos between the trumpet player and the trombone player, one of them. And it just doesn't, it's not exactly Lennon and George Harrison trading solos, is it?
Not exactly.
You know,
no.
I mean, they're trading bars, and it's both of them play beautifully. And I just don't feel any tension. Maria should have told one of them that he slept with the other's partner or something right before they recorded that, maybe. I don't know. It just feels like there's no fire in that moment.
Maria's band is a very safe space. That kind of thing does not go on there, and God bless her for it, but sometimes you got to put the tea down and pick up the whiskey. I have wondered as I listen to this and think about my reaction to it, am I just being a penis-y guy? Am I just too...
Are you a bastard?
Yeah, well, I know that. Is it a guy thing? Am I looking for qualities in music that are quote-unquote phallic and not finding them? And all I can say is, maybe. I feel like there are certainly a lot of female jazz artists who I love to death. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite trumpet players is Ingrid, to help me with her last name. God, I can see her. I can
Roland.
Hear.
Oh, God. I know who you're going to say. Oh, I almost said the wrong name. I know who you mean. Anyway, yeah, go ahead. Ingrid. Jensen,
thank you. And Ingrid Jensen, she's got the talented sister who's a sax player and a fine arranger in her own right. But yeah, I just don't feel like this is not quite the path that Gil takes, which does end up having its darknesses and its ominous byways and its obsessivenesses, its ability to become about, among other things, obsession. And yeah, this just, again, there are moments it just really seems to me like soundtrack music of uplift. It's like, now we're going to sell you something that helps with your sinuses. And that's really cruel. I mean, it's not, but just, and again, I'm not, the quality is very, very high, both technically in the arranging and, of course, the playing. Be clear, I mean, this is not in any way amateur hour. This is extremely polished, too polished production. In some ways, it may have benefited if she had less accomplished players on it just to give it some kind of grit. But yeah, I don't much care for this. I went back to Turning About, a much earlier project that had always left me feeling a little bit like this. And then I was like, oh, but this is a lot more jazzy and I like it better than Thompson Fields. So in contrast, in comparison there, I guess, that earlier project, which not, you know, it went a long time between albums of hers. And that was, again, a long time ago. She seemed like an artist I'd love Gil Evans. I've got a lot of patience for the impressionistic side of things. I certainly don't mind certain kinds of mellow jazz, but yeah, this doesn't, again, I mean, I love Bossa Nova. I love some of Paul Desmond's projects, not all of them, but some I quite like, but there is a different kind of energy there. I mean, it's about cool, but acting out cool. This is not a cool project in the least. It's not about cool. It's very warm. It's just not warm in a way that I like much. So anyway, I keep hoping, and you know, I feel like I read something by her that seemed to indicate it was kind of on her radar that maybe this project had been a bit monochromatic in terms of mood, and that maybe she was going to do her next project would have a little more thrust and energy, because you know these pieces are 13 minutes, and at least one I remember starts with this great waltz feel to it, and it's like she feels obligated somewhere to kind of deconstruct that, break it down, and make yet another drifting, seemingly directionless piece out of it. I'm like, you know, it's okay to have forward momentum sometimes. It doesn't all have to be drifting clouds. In many ways, I think in the modern consciousness, if you asked who's the better arranger, people would say Maria Schneider. They would never say Carla Bley. I just think Carla at her best is just got a grasp of form that is, for me, much greater. Now, she's also a very uneven artist, but she knows how to take a nugget and just make it to you're almost crazy with attention. And I'd like to hear more of that here. So anyway, yeah, neither of us were super fond of this one. there are a couple bonus tracks that you could download if you bought it from Artishare, and both of them, one is actually a bossa nova, and the other one is like Dance You Monster Dance. Both of them have a little more spark and energy than the main album, so maybe that indicates that she's drifting away from this really focused, I don't know, on sentiment and warmth, and you know, I hope the next project is scrawkier. I really do. Maybe get Tim Byrne in on baritone sax. That might help. Well, are you ready to talk about your all-time favorite young big band leader, composer, arranger, D'Arcy James Argue?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And this is a wild one. After his first record, the next two have been kind of multimedia projects. So Brooklyn Babylon was more than just a soundtrack. It had other multimedia elements. And this Real Enemies recording from 16 also has all sorts of clips that it was playing and videos. And he was directing it apparently on top of a giant doomsday clock where the second hand was ticking down and everyone nice. Was dressed as if they were from some kind of 50s noir film.
Yeah.
So
I'm glad you mentioned that. That's interesting. What I noticed this time listening to this, and I do like the hell out of this. I think Brooklyn Babylon is his most accomplished work, but he's just someone to watch. He should get a MacArthur Genius Grant. Just give him one already. So I liked his first album. What is it? Something Machines, something
Infernal
Combustible Machines.
There you go. Infernal Machines. Yeah.
Which was really good. And then Brooklyn Babylon, we both sort of had orgasms over. And this isn't as accomplished as Brooklyn Babylon, but it's awfully good. And on listening to it again this time, one of the things I noticed was how many gestures he borrowed from the 50s, either TV soundtracks or movie soundtracks. How many of the cuts here start with muted trumpets playing staccato, you know, da 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 da? We had done that show about bad TV jazz. Remember, we did all those
four or five detective shows. City.
That's the worst one. And D'Arcy's been listening to those, and virtually every song incorporates elements from that era. So he's hearkening back to a period, you know, 60 years before, in order to sort of, as a kind of starting place for the sonic landscape. And the whole album is a concept jazz album, if you will, about paranoia and conspiracy. And we talked at length about the vocal number. Many of the songs will have clips of news audio.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion.
And some of it's quite recognizable, some of it less recognizable. There's a clip of George Bush Sr., the famous New World Order speech.
Right.
There's bits and pieces of the Ollie North hearings. There's Jimmy Carter talking about the time he thought he saw a UFO when he was in the Navy, you know, which is really, really funny. But there's this one verbal number, and you like it less. I like it more. Every time I hear it, it's the 12th out of 13 songs here. So he put it near the end, called Who Do You Trust? And it's got that TV noir detective narrator, that sort of slightly over-caffeinated acidic voice. And it's just reading a monologue about people who believe in conspiracy theories. And it's fucking brilliant. I just I love it. And it's not about the music in that particular song, because the music is really just sort of an ominous backdrop to this speech. But that speech is really well written.
It's a nice last, it just explains everything you just heard.
It's brilliant, and it's a great summation of what went before. And I love the playing here. Darcy James Argue is a consummate orchestrator and arranger, and this is of course very arranged. And I like it enormously. It as a concept album, and jazz has some concept albums, some famous concept albums. You know, this fits in nicely. This is a smart take on all of this, and given recent event in the last 6 months, kind of timely. Although he probably wasn't thinking that when he made it, but
Just the last couple of weeks where did the Russians get sex tape footage of Trump in some hotel where Trump's saying no? You know, always assume there are cameras in Russian hotels, as if he has a good reason to know that.
Right,
it's amazing. It's frighteningly pertinent in a way that was between leaks from the FBI and.
Yeah.
From Russia, did they change the outcome of a really crucial presidential election? I mean, he really could do this whole piece again using clips from the last 6 months of political discourse with no problem.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. You totally. Yeah. I enjoyed the hell out of this. It's a great deal of fun. It's not, like I said, it's not Brooklyn Babylon, which I think is a work of great majesty. But this is very good and extremely enjoyable.
Yeah, as a concept album, I guess part of my difficulty with it, and I like it, I mean, I think it's very good, is that if you look at like The Black Saint and the Sinner Lady by Mingus, the concept is expressed musically, right? And whatever that's about, the emotions boiling through it are expressed in purely musical means, just as take Brooklyn Babylon out of the context of the multimedia presentation, and it kind of does its musical work on its own very successfully. And here, the use of the recorded voice clips of Kennedy or Carter, they both make the thesis a little too obvious, and they aren't as interestingly integrated. They are just played. I mean, he's not building. I can imagine somebody taking snippets of these speeches and turning them into kind of a hypnotic musical repetition, or layering them, or doing them, using them as an element of the music as well as a message vehicle. These are kind of plastered over his arrangements, just giving you the message, and it's not super tightly on the thesis. In other words, Nancy Reagan snippet from Just Say No, it brings back a certain kind of political period. But I don't know that particularly it's about a kind of crude and failed attempt at brainwashing. It's not really about conspiracy. It's this idiotic idea that the way one doesn't take drugs is by just deciding not to, ignoring any sociological or other influential factors that might lead one to want to take drugs in some context and not in others. So yeah, some of the clips, Jimmy Carter talking about the UFO and me just getting a flashback of how weird the fucking 70s really were. It's like, holy shit, our president said, of course, now we're all going to have flashbacks about how weird the 2010s were. Ah, remember when he tweeted that? As we say in the smoke of nuclear rubble. It's some of them I don't know are as on point as they could be in general, and they kind of dominate your imagination. Now, many of the songs really don't have clips at all. It struck me on one of my listens that a lot of this is just music. It's just you tend to remember the speech snippets because they speak, as it were, literally to a part of your brain that is wired to kind of take in information very efficiently, and music is a more abstract thing, and it doesn't, for most of us, convey that immediately, and we typically are not getting musical messages that are as crucial as speech messages like look out for that bus or you're fired or etc. It's just we kind of give them a different priority, most of us, in our day-to-day life. So I liked it. I think it's good. I love Darcy James Argue. He's kind of a mad genius, and I don't know how much of that is his pose, dressing like he's part of a steampunk Victorian novel, how much of it is real. He seems kind of aware that to do this at all, to have this project of a big band in the 21st century, is kind of a quixotic, bizarre thing to do. It's not economically viable. It takes huge amounts of willpower and energy to pull off at all, just to get the people together in one spot. And it's not necessarily rewarded in the way that just touring with a small group as a solo or being a writer for hire would be. So, yeah, he kind of sees himself as almost a comically obsessed figure. So he's a bit of a hipster, but not an undurable. And an interesting interview with him in the latest Jazz Times, along with interviews with Carla Bley. I mean, it's just kind of a weird nugget-filled issue of that magazine of people I'm interested in and want to hear talking at length to interviewers. It's like, wow, all in one place. How convenient. This is a month for me. All right, cool. Yeah, it's definitely a recommendation for me. I like the Foreman Act better, but, you know, I like them both. Really, the Thompson Fields is the only album I feel like I'm unlikely to go back to very often at all of the four.
Yeah, I agree.
Cool. So, fingers crossed we made it. This is got cut to digits. Any thoughts about, I know it's only been a week and you've been traveling and you're doing this hot from a Holiday Inn or something.
Yeah. This is a first for us. We're doing a podcast where I'm in a motel in the middle of the country during an ice storm. So
there you go. And I'm just happy that I've got big old black back. My computer's running again.
Yeah.
Real reassuring when the kid who's about, I don't know, 10, 11, it's hard to say, comes out with it. Well, here's your computer back. And he's looking around. It's like, it's really heavy and I can't write a check if I'm holding it. So he thinks, well, maybe I'll put it on this 1-inch thick curved facade that's in front of this desk that no one sits at anymore and see if I can balance it there. And I thought, you know, that's incredibly stupid. Let me pick it up and put it in this empty cubicle over here where it won't fall down and crash. Yeah, we replaced the power unit. It was so many hertz. I'm like, watts? Yeah, so many watts. I'm like, great. Yeah. Power unit. Hertz. That's, yeah.
Yeah, it hurts all right.
It does hurt, but it works. It works. I'm so happy it's back. So,
excellent.
Any pop matters after that little rant?
No, sure. I have been listening, but it's got a variety of things to help make travel better, but this doesn't make travel better. Recently went into the rotation, the 2-disc set of Swan's To Be Kind. Oh my god, it's like someone had a drug nightmare and recorded it on a double album. What the fuck? I was listening to this, I'm driving across the country, and so I stay in motels, you know, and I was listening to this last night and I was like, I'm really scared. What the hell? I mean, you know, I'm familiar with these guys. We actually did a podcast about one of their albums, and they've been around forever, and they're sort of critically respected and commercially nil. But this was my first listen to this one, and I was like, dear God, this is scary. I mean, it's actually scary. But then I think we said that about, what did we do?
We did The Seer way back in episode 38. We did kind of a prog cast, and
right.
Wow.
Yeah. That was a scary, yeah.
There's
so
a scary
this
animal
is,
on that one. This one's got a scary baby, I think.
It's got scary babies. 2 babies.
They're even scarier than animals, people. Trust me.
I have no idea what the titles mean. All I know is I was listening to this as I was, you know, laying in bed. I was just going to let it run out. And I was like, you know what? I think I'll turn that off now and maybe replace it with some Paul Chambers because that will help me sleep better. I was like, what the hell?
We're just a little boy for Chester Burnett. It's just, I'm just a little boy. I was like, oh, my God.
I was listening to Sideman, the Paul Chambers disc of Coltrane as a Sideman. And so that's
Yeah,
that's relatively soothing after Swan's, like having some kind of psychotic episode for a double album. You know,
so
I, honestly,
Root Canal.
I know. I thought, oh, I'll listen to this before I go to bed. So I'm laying in bed and I've got the laptop open and it's playing it. And I'm like, I think not. So I don't want to, like, you know, jump out the window at 3 a.m.
Yeah, kids, if you go to sleep to Swans, you're just younger and tougher than they are. I'm past the point of attempting that particular experiment.
Ugh.
They're a sunny daytime. I have listened to them in the dark walking home from church, and it just makes you want to run back there, doesn't it? You know, and hope
it does.
Holy water to kind of purify what you've been through.
And they have a huge discography. I mean, I'm interested in hearing more of them. But yeah, I just sort of, you know, started listening to that yesterday, and I thought, let's save this for the daytime drive. Let's listen to this before bed. Ugh, holy shit.
So anything else on your mind?
Nah. Okay. I just want to get home. I want to get out of the... I don't mind driving in snow. I don't mind cold weather. What I hate is ice storms.
Oh,
ice storms.
Ice storms. Ice
storms really suck ass. They're terrible. My car, my little car, weighed about 400 pounds extra after I left Missouri today because the entire car was covered with like an inch layer of ice.
Oh, my
and I like heated the windows so that I could chip away, you know, but I wasn't going to like chip all the ice off the car. And I'm sure it affected my mileage because the entire car, I was driving an ice car for about 5 hours. By the way, when did they start naming land-based storms? Because, of course, I've been watching Weather Channel to find out. This is Winter Storm Justin or something, you know. I think they should have called it Donald, but they name land-based storms now. I didn't know they did that.
I guess the Midwest must have signed some kind of petition. It's like, we want to recognize our shit, too.
You live in the Midwest. I figured you could give me information about this.
I must have missed it.
I'm assuming they're always named for meteorologist's ex-husband or ex-wife.
I'm hoping next time to have a couple new records to discuss. I actively went in search of some new music because right now I'm, of course, listening to a lot of jazz. I didn't really pick up any pop. And then I have this massive 86-disc set of all the early music recordings released on the S-E-O-N label. I don't know how to say it. Whether it's Seon or whatever, it's like a German-based label. So basically my little office at the law office has been a fucking Renaissance fair for the last couple of weeks. It's like, more recorders, bring them on.
Plinky, plink, plink.
Yeah, I've got like 10 discs of organ music, and I don't know. We'll see. Some of it's really delightful. I did at some point read a review somewhere that said this is a great deal. And of course, I mean, it's, my God, they're probably like less than $2 a disc. I think much less, closer to $1 a disc. And, you know, I'm kind of interested in that period, but it's a lot. It's not as much as the John Denver I sent you. It's more in number, but less in pain. But it's a lot of Renaissance music. It turns out it's really good if you're just cranking documents out to have Handel's wind sonatas, because nothing, you know, it's all, there are no Sturm und Drang emotions there. It's just kind of recorder having a good day. La 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 la. Yeah, it's very soothing at some level. And if you
need
a slightly heavier Gregorian chant. And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 108. We know it was kind of a short one. We'd love to hear from you. Do you prefer them shorter? Or do you like it when we go on 90 minutes or more? Let us know. You can contact us at mike@jazzbastard.com or pat@jazzbastard.com or, of course, on our Facebook page. You can download the podcast from www.jazzbastard.com or from iTunes. Tune in next time as we discuss several vinyl albums I've picked up recently, including work by Jane Ira Bloom, Hannibal Marvin Peterson, Jeff Parker, Stone Alliance,
yes,
and Los Admiradores. Until next time, take care.
Something's moving there in the corner.
It looks like smoke. There's another one.
All right, I'm ready.
Okay. Mike, I'm going to ask you to dim the lights and put that sacred oil I gave you on your forehead. We're going to attempt the first long-distance seance. We are trying to contact the ghost of our Big Band podcast. It died twice. Can we reach it before the grave? So are the lights dim?
The lights are dim.
Okay.
They're not the only thing that's dim around here. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, I've got my Ouija board out. Just give me a minute.
Your Ouija board.
I'm trying to reach the spirits. Just be very calm. Listeners, this has taken place before you're hearing it, but Just be quiet in the dark, too, if you possibly can. Okay, I'm moving. I'm getting a word.
What makes you think our listeners turn out the lights when they listen to us?
I just assume...
I assume our listeners are heavily medicated when they listen to us.
It's a romantic background. So
they ask their keeper to turn up the podcast.
You're disturbing the spirits. Now, the first word is forming. Okay, it's W-A... Wake. Okay, well, this is good. We've reached the podcast. It wants to awaken. That makes sense. Me. Okay, well... The podcast has a personal identity. I had not expected that. But that's fine. Podcast, if you want to think of yourself as a me, that's a... Oh, shit. It says, wake me up before you go-go. We've reached George Michael's ghost. Shit. Okay. This is not working. We're just going to have to redo it. But we made a good faith attempt.
So I'm thinking that if this, our third attempt at this particular show, goes wrong, we won't really have lost much if we lose that intro.
That's true.
How long did you think of that? How long did it take you to think of that?
Several seconds.